I'd like to read to you from the first part of Deuteronomy chapter 6. And what I've got I call Listen Up. You'll see why, I think, as we read a passage that probably is very, very familiar to a number of you, as it is historically to, and always has been to Jews. Let's read and we'll see it. So Moses, of course, on the southeast corner of the Promised Land, just outside of Canaan, up in the mountains of Moab, a wonderful viewpoint, looking over the land. On a clear day, you could almost see over to the Mediterranean from this viewpoint. And the anticipation is, what matters when you get into the land? What matters? And that's what Deuteronomy is about, but that also is what this is about. This is the commandment, the statutes and rules that the Lord your God, Moses says, commanded me to teach you, and you may do them in the land to which you are going over to possess it, that you may fear the Lord your God, you and your son's son, by keeping all his statutes and his commandments, which I command you in all the days of your life, and that your days may be long. Hear, therefore, O Israel, and be careful to do them, that it may go well with you, and that you may multiply greatly, as the Lord, the God of your fathers, has promised you in a land flowing with milk and honey. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. And you shall love. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your might. And these words I command you today shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, when you rise up. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes, and you shall even write them on the doorposts of your houses and on your gates. And then we have the injunction. Father, may this be something which captures our imaginations, captures our ways of being, not just the things that we do or say, important as they are, but deep within our very, very souls, may it capture our whole way of being so that we see the things that are first and can then have other things follow to express and affirm what's first. And I pray that in Jesus' name. Together we ask it in his name. Amen. Amen. There is a quotation you perhaps have heard that has been variously attributed, well, definitely to Augustine, and also to someone a few years later, Thomas Cranmer. And it goes like this. It says, "What the heart loves, the will chooses, and the mind justifies." Now, if you've heard that before, enjoy it. I'd like to build around it here. And if you haven't heard it, I would like to say it again, because I'd like you to notice the way it links and the order of the linkage, which is very important, because I think it expresses something going on in Deuteronomy 4. Let me read it again. What the heart loves, that's where it starts, a whole orientation. What the heart loves, the will chooses, the mind justifies. And the reason that is such an insightful piece is it goes very much in the opposite direction of much of our thinking. Much of our thinking is, I don't know about you, but when I, you know, get to meet someone for the first time, I'm interested, you know, what do they do? You know, why do they do it? What are they thinking about, you know, anything in life? And that's nothing wrong with going from that point of view. But often what we think is not, at least not first level, what drives us through life, if this statement is true. If this statement is true, it's what we value, what we treasure, what we prioritize, what we're in love with, tends to drive our life. And then other things follow, and the mind then kicks in and starts to work with, well, you know, what's going on with this love that I have for someone or something, and then tends to work accordingly. In other words, the claim in this statement is where your inclinations are going, where your heart's desires are taking you, then brings along your thinking and your rationalization, and they come to serve the things you love. By the way, a quick aside with no time to play out on this, this is a very important piece for pastoral counseling, because though we often explore what people think worthy of its own right, it's what they love that will give us more understanding of ourselves as well as others. But that's just an extra for no extra charge. Psalm 44:21, God knows the secrets of the heart. Romans 10:10, with the heart one believes. This is interesting because, you know, belief involves both affirming something as well as trusting something. But this starts with the heart. It doesn't say what you believe to be true, you'll go on to love. There's lots of things I believe are true or even accurate, but it doesn't mean I love them necessarily. But with the heart, one believes at least in God. How do we know that Peter was successful in preaching at Pentecost? It tells us they were pierced to the heart. Yeah. And what do we have in Ephesians in that fundamental expression of what it is to be a Christian? Right? And by the way, I'm admitting something before I read this to you. I admit that for many, many years, I thought true orthodoxy involved what one thought, because that's an important piece of orthodoxy. All agreed. But it says there, Christ makes his residence in your heart as God would in a traditional temple. See, so the heart is what's coming up to the fore. It's not discounting what we think, how we think, our rationale. No insult there, but it's always going back to the heart, the source of your feelings, your inclinations, your priorities, metaphorically speaking, of course. And so every time we're dealing with God's commands, it's tempting, humanly, to think of them as a checklist. But what Deuteronomy 6:4 says is really what's going on with all these things. It's a heart issue. Commands will come, obligations come, but it starts there. And it's this word listen. Some of you have done your Hebrew. You know that it's Shema or Shameh. All right, listen here, listen up. Right, that's the meaning of it. If you're an avid reader of Anglo-Saxon, you may recognize the Anglo-Saxon origin that starts Beowulf. I don't know if any of you know this. What? The origin of our word what, not W-A-T-T, the other lesser known what. All right? What? You know? Listen up. It's the same idea. When do you say listen up to someone? The answer, of course, is when they must pay attention because it's something very, very important. It's important because it, you know, is bigger than other things. It's important maybe because of their safety, you know. Listen up. You know, don't do that. It might imperil you. You want to do something else. When you're specifying directions to someone and they're going to be complicated, say, listen up. I'm going to explain a couple things here. All right, listen up. And it's fittingly the verse, the whole of Deuteronomy 6:4, is a verse so often inscribed over synagogue entrances today. Try this out sometime, and if you want to save yourself some travel, just Google it. Okay, much easier and cheaper. But look for synagogue entrances in North America as elsewhere, and you'll find it could be in English, it could be another language, it could be in the Hebrew. Okay, remember it could be in various languages. But this verse is what greets people every time they come to worship in so many places. Listen up. The Lord your God, the Lord is one. You say, okay, I'll buy the idea. I'm a monotheist, right? I believe in one God. Why is that so important? By the way, let me just add to the synagogue piece. According to Josephus, in the first century, synagogues reflected, in fact, what faithful Jews, he says anyway, were doing is they would recite this passage, in usually in Hebrew, probably twice a day. In other words, every day they're saying there's something about the oneness of God that is above anything else. I want to just think about that a couple minutes with you. Listen up, God alone, one God only, not more than one. And if there's only one, his characteristics are unique. And if something is unique, it's hard to understand it. Now, I'm not going to say it's beyond understanding. I'm just saying if it's unique, it's hard to understand it because you don't have other things, other correspondences by which to understand it. You've got to sort of take it in its own territory. Sui generis, one of a kind, all right? And that's a challenge. So there's something undiscernible about God, as well as the things we can understand. No pantheon, no claim of rival powers, but this one God is the one who, in all of his uniqueness, called out of nothing into existence, at least as I have read, 10 to the 26th power number of suns in the universe. Now, I didn't count them personally. Okay? But that's at least a responsible scientific number that implies something on the hundreds of billions of suns in just one galaxy, and there are billions of galaxies. And this one God brings all this into existence. That's beyond me. That really is beyond me. I believe it's true, but I'm sure I don't understand it all. And that God, that creator, that sustainer, brought you and me and everybody else into existence. That's the one God. So why does it matter to say to someone, all the things that are important to you today, and you know, we all have the things that we would say matter to us. They're sort of on our, you know, our mental to-do list of the things that matter today. Of all those things, why does believing in one God matter? And then is it just believing, or is there something else? Well, it goes on to tell us it's not just knowing a fact, but loving the person, loving God. Verse 5, you shall love him with everything that's inside of you, every bit of your energy. You must appreciate, as by the way, we appreciate excellence in lots of areas, right? Excellence in sports, excellence in technology, excellence in music and entertainment, excellence in skills, you know, people who can do things with such apparent ease and they're so good. We appreciate excellence. Excellence and uniqueness in God, you see, if you love something more than anything else, everything that you're about starts to be channeled in the direction of what comes first. What comes first? I read and actually reread recently, this is always amazing to me, a delightful example of two people who in a seemingly impossible situation caught the significance of this. If you read Paul Johnson's fairly substantial classic History of the Jews, it's a very long piece, it's very accessible, very easy to read. He tells a story in there about some Jews in Berlin, this is in the heart of Nazi Germany, in Berlin, during World War II, who were among, and the number is impressive, it's estimated up to 160,000 Jews somehow evade capture in the greater area of Berlin in World War II through some incredibly brave and risky and creative kinds of means. And he tells a story about some guys who became what became known as U-boats. Okay. Now, of course, U-boat was a submarine, you know, an Unterwasserboot, an underwater boat. That's what a U-boat is, strictly speaking. But what these people did is they would have a bed specially made, in which the bed actually was not just the mattress on a frame, but there was a slender box-like structure under the mattress in which a person could hide, and it would appear that it was just the bed itself, when in fact there was a person there, okay? And it tells about a couple of guys, one of whom, this is amazing to me, one of whom lived with a woman who was related to one of the highest ranking Nazi officers, and she was in love with this Jewish man, so she made a one of these special beds for this guy to become a U-boat, okay, as they called them. And what they would do is, if it was daytime or if there were Nazis around and there was a risk of being, you know, detected, they would climb into this fake bed, into this chamber. There was some breathing room, usually a little glass of water, and a couple of cough suppressant pills as well, part of the reality. Anyway, one day this particular woman, this sister of a high-ranking Nazi general, comes home, and I guess there'd been some dangers, and the dangers had dissipated, and she enters in, and there are these two U-boats there, a guy named Willy Bushoff and another, and they've emerged from their U-boat for the day, and they're screaming, not screaming, but calling out, chanting out at the top of their voices, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one." Right in the middle of Berlin, in the center of Nazi Germany. What a lovely, defiant statement in the face and against all odds, as we might say humanly, that these things are true and prevail when it doesn't seem possible. Anyway, back to this. Lord observes the heart. He knows the secrets of the heart. Your heart, my heart, unfortunately. Right. Sometimes we know things on our heart that we wish weren't there. Sometimes we're surprised at things that were in our heart that we didn't know were there. That can happen as well. By the way, let's add in, sometimes, this is the good news, sometimes God has developed our hearts in good ways that we also did not know were there until we were put to the test and in some way prevailed. There's good news in there as well, right? But we want to be careful about what's on our heart. Proverbs talks about monitoring what's in our heart with all of our energy. It gives, on the one hand, well-known statements like, the heart's inclined towards evil. In other words, without some positive pressure or direction of, you know, whatever sort, there's a kind of there's a leaning we have that means, if you will, our default tendencies are not good because of sin. G.K. Chesterton put it nicely. He said, there's many, many angles at which a man may fall, but only one at which he can remain upright, right? So the inclination is there. But the good news, of course, is hearts can get cleaned and straightened, purified, led ahead. So the sobering stuff is there. It's not happy news, but it's not the only news. There's more to it that is also in there. And so we're advised in many places in the Bible to guard our hearts, because we can sometimes fall in love with things without really being aware what it is. You know, Tim Keller talks about deep idols. He distinguishes it from surface idols. Rosaria Champagne Butterfield has talked in very, very similar language, by the way, in some of what she has written and spoken, that sometimes you have surface problems and they're real problems and real issues. He's not denying that. But sometimes those are animated by a yet-to-be-identified, under-the-surface love for something. All right? And that's a hard thing to read. Surface behaviors are challenging enough to read, but attitudes that drive those behaviors, that's really a challenge. And figuring out, you know, what are the things that you really, really prioritize, that you really, really would sacrifice yourself for, that you really, really think are so enduring and so big and always there to be held on to, in contrast to the things that challenge them and make us think, well, the principles can be torn down. We need to be aware of what those things are that our heart is loving And that's part of knowing ourselves. And I will add as a kind of a final piece to this, a thing that maybe it's obvious, but I thought, where does Deuteronomy at least take this? Hear, listen, love, because everything that's commanded is going towards what we love. It's interesting that it immediately goes then to say, and help your children with these things. I thought there's many other ways it could have gone that would have made sense, you know, teach your neighbor, you know, preach it to your congregation. There's a place for those. But its first one is to go to your children. And I think probably, this is reasonable, you know, your children, especially when they're younger, they're more impressionable, right? They will kind of take it for granted as you're raising them. There are the folks, you know, they've always been there. They're sort of part, you become part of their assumptive world, as we call it. They just take it for granted, which is always something to work with. Now, it can be abused, but I'm saying something to be worked with. And their childrenhood has no expiration date. You realize that? Now, the nature of the relationship changes. You don't want to be treating your 25-year-old like a toddler. That's wrong, right? But they're still your children. And it's why, as I, at my age, relate to kids in their upper 20s and 30s, they're still my children. And it's why my 91-year-old father still talks to me in certain ways. He's still my dad. You know, that hasn't expired. Changes and morphs, but it doesn't expire. We're in frequent contact, and they get to ask a question: does what this person say bear out in the way they live and relate to me? Because the ideal is that what we say is affirmed by what we do. We say we love God. Oh, there are tangible ways in which we're making that real. They're in a great position to be able to look at that in us, as we were in that with our parents. So pursue God, love God, listen, one God, but love Him more than anything else. That's a fundamental foundation piece for life, for anyone, anywhere, at any time. We're going to sing from Psalm 81. Where's Ed? B. 81B. Let's stand together to sing.